Well, thank you, Don, and thank you to everyone who is attending today. This is a great topic and a great opportunity to talk about nutrient management for me. As Don said, I am new to this position. I started about 2.5 months ago. Unfortunately, during most of that time, I have been stuck doing some programmatic stuff rather than the technical side. So I'm excited for my duties on the program issues I've been working on to be finished and be wrapped up so I can get into what I consider the fun part of my job of nutrient management. So today I'm just going to go through a little bit of the background of who NRCS is and what we do, and then go into some of those challenges that have already been talked about this morning and some of the opportunities. And I think that throughout the presentations today, we're all going to touch on the importance of building relationships and partnerships, because that's the only way we can really make these changes in water quality. So as I said, I'll give the background on NRCS and what we do. We're an agency of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I am housed in what's called the Ecological Sciences Division, and us, along with the Conservation Engineering Division, we're kind of what I like to consider the technical backbone of the agency. We come up with the standards, we come up with the technical policy, any of the regulation that we will pass down to our field offices. And one of the key components that I really enjoy is the training of our field staff. We have field staff spread out all across the United States, the territories, and it's a great opportunity. I used to be able to say that we have a person in every county. However, due to staffing, we now have what we call work units. So there isn't always a physical person in a county, but there's always people that are responsible for servicing those counties. So farmers hopefully have access to one of our field staff, no matter where they are located. And we also have field staff that work on tribal lands. But what we do is we provide conservation assistance, both technical assistance and financial assistance, and I'll get into the difference between those. But one of the keys that we like to stress is that we are voluntary. The services that we provide are voluntary and non-regulatory, which means a farmer can come to us, work with us to assess what's going on their farm, and it's their choice whether they want to move forward in implementing any possible solutions. Conservation practices is what we refer to them as, or if they want to wait or walk away and not do anything. So everything that we do is voluntary. So a little bit about the technical assistance. We have a 9-step conservation planning process that our field staff uses when they go out to work with farmers. Farmers, ranchers, landowners, all refer to them as farmers or producers, because I'm an agronomist by trade, and that's what I usually call them, just farmers. but we have this process where we go out, we talk to the farmer about what's going out on their farm. We walk their farm with them and talk to them about, over the course of time, what their possible resource concerns are. We do some resource assessments. And we also talk to them about what their objectives are. Do they have a wildlife objective? Are they just crop focused? Do they mainly want to work on improving their crop, their nutrient management, their IPM strategies, whatever they their objectives are? And over the course of their conversation and the planning process, we develop a conservation plan. And all of these conservation plans are developed with a listing of conservation practices that a farmer may decide to include and eventually implement on their land. And these conservation practice standards are a big part of what the technical staff does at our headquarters, is develop practice standards. These are science-based practice standards that are used to address resource concern. They have to have some resource concern purpose to exist, and they need to be science-based. They obviously are revised every 5 years at a minimum. Every practice standard is reviewed and revised if needed. Same thing if there's a big advance or a science breakthrough that comes through that is related to one of these standards, we may shorten up that time frame and do a review and revision in a shorter amount of time. But what these practice standards provide is they provide our field offices with what the practice is, a definition, where it's applicable, and then the minimum criteria that they would need to use when they're developing a site-specific plan for that farmer to implement the practice. And the joke in our office is that we come up with a national practice standard, and then there's 51 ways or more that it is interpreted by all of the states and the offices. And the states do have some flexibility. When they get a national standard, they can choose to adopt that standard and have it offered in their state or not if it's not applicable. There are certain practices that are very regional that states will not have those resource concerns. They would not need that practice to be offered. As well, some states may have some higher level regulations or laws that need to be incorporated in a practice standard so they can be made state specific. In addition to practice standards, we have conservation activities. One of the big ones that's relevant to this is edge of field monitoring. These aren't necessarily a practice that's going to be put in place to solve a resource concern, but more to monitor, assess what's going on out there. And that's been one that we have really been excited about. And last but not least, we have conservation activity plans. And these are really conservation plans that are more land use or specific to a situation. It may be a grazing plan or a nutrient management plan or an organic transition plan. And these are, I list them last because I'm getting ready to get into financial assistance. And CAPs are kind of a mix of technical assistance and financial assistance. In this situation, the technical assistance is actually offered by a technical service provider. And these are trained people. In the situation of cropland, it would be someone like a CCA or a crop consultant who has went through the process to become a certified technical service provider for specific practices. One of the successes that we've had with these CAPs and how they're done is these technical service providers produce the plans. We get into a contract with the farmer who actually pays for these plans, and it's usually a flat rate based on what type of plan it is, and then the farmer and the technical service provider agree to an amount that they will be paid for that plan. But one of the successes we have had with CAPS that I've seen myself, as Don said, I was previously in North Carolina as a state agronomist. And one of the ways that CAPs were successful, there's a group called the Carolina Farm Stewardship Association, which is active in both North and South Carolina. And they had a retired extension professor on staff that was working with organic farmers. And he had an extensive amount of experience with cover crops and really conservation planning without really even realizing he was conservation planning. And he became a technical service provider and was able to work with the customers or the members of this Farm Stewardship Association to help write organic transition plans, and they were CAPs. And so he was able to write these plans, and the plans that he provided were excellent. And it's an opportunity for someone who has that working relationship with the farmers, and one of the benefits that we have of using CAPs is the technical service providers have the luxury of time. One of the things with our field staff that we find is that we are very short on time. We're spread very thin. Like most other organizations, there are fewer people doing more work. And a CAP provides a technical service provider that can actually go out and spend more time on the ground with the farmer, learning more about what their challenges are. Sometimes when we go out to a field office, out to a farmer's field, we have one day or maybe 2 days that we spend with them, talking to them about what their objectives are, what their concerns are. And some of these technical service providers have already been working with these farmers, or they have the opportunity to go back and forth with them and visit the farm multiple times. So I see CAPs as being a win-win. And once those CAPs are produced, that farmer can bring that CAP into our offices and receive financial assistance. which is the next other side of what we do, the technical assistance and that financial assistance, which unfortunately has become a big part of what our agency does, which is great. It's great to be able to provide financial assistance to help get conservation practices on the ground. The stress is that we have field staff that were hired as scientists that or conservationists that really wanted to work with farmers. They didn't want to sit behind a computer and write contracts. So we're working through some of those kinks and getting some staff in that do more of the contracting side to hopefully get some of the field staff back into the field. But how we offer financial assistance is through a couple of big programs. The best known is EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. And what this program does is it helps cost share from 50% to 75% of the typical cost of implementing a practice, and the costs are generated, the typical cost is generated on a local regional scale, so hopefully they're close to what the typical cost is of implementing a practice. This can be anything from a grass waterway to installing some pollinator habitat on the site of your farm to nutrient management planning. One of the other big programs that we have is a conservation stewardship program. And this program is kind of, I like to call it the step above EQIP, because this is really for those farmers that have already done a lot of the basic practices. They've already implemented the grass waterways. They've addressed soil erosion on their farm. And maybe they want to go a step up. They want to start focusing on soil health, or they want to start working on some wildlife practices. It's meant to enhance what's already going on out at the farm. And this program pays basically for the farmer to maintain or improve the current system that they have, and also that little bit of enhancement to encourage them to go a step farther. And this is the program when I complained at the beginning of my presentation about working on programmatic stuff. This is the program that I have been working on the technical side of it, because it's being reinvented, if you will. That's probably not the technical term of what our agency is calling it, but in January there will be a rollout of this program, and it's kind of going to have some tweaks and changes. I think they're definitely for the better for the farmer and for our field staff, so that's something to be looking at. Under EQIP, we actually have a lot of different initiatives, and we have water quality initiatives, we have air quality initiatives, we have had organic and wildlife initiatives, and it's basically initiative just means we pull a section of the EQIP dollars that we are allocated, and we use those to really target priority watersheds or priority landscapes and habitats for a specific resource concern. And one of the big ones that we have, which Secretary Vilsack earlier this month actually just committed the Natural Resource Conservation Service to investing $30 million per year for the next 3 years. And this will help fund 33 new practices, as well as fund 40 awesome existing practices and projects that are ongoing in the Mississippi River Basin. And these are really great initiatives. They give us the ability to really target conservation to priority watersheds. So it's not just what I like to call random acts of conservation. You put a grass waterway in an isolated field somewhere, and it is doing good for that small area, but if you concentrate and put grass waterways and or cover crops, start doing nutrient management, IPM, and you start doing that in one watershed concentrated, you're going to have a bigger impact. And some of these practices can take years before we see the benefits. And so by concentrating them, we'll hopefully help speed up that process before we see the benefits show up. I won't spend too much time going through these challenges, the nutrient, sediment, water quality. I think everyone who's online and in the room is aware of these challenges. The watersheds, the hypoxia task forces, most states in the basin have their nutrient reduction strategies, which is a great projects that we've been involved in, and I anticipate a lot of the initiative money will be going to fund some of those projects to help get those nutrient reduction strategies moving or help them along. One of the biggest challenges that I see, since my position is with nutrient management, is nutrient management planning. And our nutrient management practice standard is actually based on 4R site-specific nutrient management. And I say that it's a challenge because we can create great plans. Getting those plans implemented for years to come is the challenge. It's really about awareness. It's about letting the farmers know it's a win-win situation. Carrie did a great job explaining the 4R nutrient stewardship framework. And one of the biggest challenges for us is to get our own field staff up to speed, make sure that they are trained up so that they can create these plans, as well as working with our partners to help facilitate nutrient management planning. One of the goals that I have in my position is I want to look at all of the tools that are out there that ag retailers and crop consultants are using for their nutrient management planning and find out which ones, I have a good feeling several of them will, meet our nutrient management practice standard. And to be able to utilize those plans for financial assistance from our agency rather than our field staff creating plans when the farmer may already have one with a consultant is really an objective that I want to look at and make a priority in my job is look at what exists and try to find a way to help bridge that gap because we just don't have the staff to create nutrient management plans. One of the things that we have that's going to be released sometime shortly, I touched base with the person that's working on it last week, hoping he would be able to tell me a date, is the manure report. There was a report that was issued, I believe, in 2000 that looked at U.S. Census data, and it basically developed trends of livestock production from 1982 to 1997. And this new report will go into 2007, and it will also look at programmatic NRCS practices that have been implemented through 2014. And the goal of the project was to look at where manure is being produced, where it's being utilized, and where there is excess. And the data was pulled, it's a very data-heavy report, and it is based on farm level as well as county level statistics. And so it's very helpful for us because we want to make sure that the waste management practices that we are implementing are being directed to the areas where they are needed most. And the great thing is there are very few counties in the U.S. that show a county level excess. And so that's very, that's good news. There still are those counties that have excess nutrients. Where are they going to go? How are we going to get those nutrients somewhere without having them end up being potential water quality problems? I realize I'm going slow. And even though we're mainly talking about water quality in this session, I had to include an air quality slide. Those of you that are familiar with Secretary Vilsack back in April talking about Climate Smart Ag and the 10 building blocks, which is a framework that the USDA is going to use to try to impact and reduce emissions and greenhouse gases, specifically in agriculture and in forestry. And nutrient management has a role in that. Nutrient management planning and the 4R nutrient stewardship can definitely help reduce emissions. And so that's something that's also on our radar as a current challenge. So of these challenges, now I'm going to briefly run through the opportunities. And the great thing is the previous two speakers, and I anticipate the future speakers in this session, are going to hit on some of the same ideas, which is partnerships, building those relationships. But I always look at every challenge as an opportunity. We have to look at challenges as a reason to find an innovative new way to solve a problem and also as an opportunity to work with partners. Working with ag retailers, private sector agronomists, and crop consultants, whether that be them serving as a technical service provider or us partnering with them to use their nutrient management plans that they have produced to work with the farmers and provide them financial assistance. So we've built some great relationships over the years, and I'm hoping just to continue building on that. And one of those successes has been the 4R site-specific nutrient management. And Carrie already highlighted Laura Moody, who's in the crowd with the Fertilizer Institute, and we had an agreement with them, which wrapped up in 2013 before I was up working on these. And one of the great outcomes of that agreement were online training modules, which really the focus and the primary goal was to increase awareness of the 4R nutrient management. These training modules are still available online. They are free. They are an excellent resource. This is going to be one of the key documents that I use when I update our staff training. And so it's definitely a great agreement that was very successful, in my opinion. Also, we want to continue our work with local soil and water conservation districts and tribal partners. I am working with USET, the United South and Eastern Tribes Incorporated, and they have an agreement with EPA, where what we are trying to gather is success stories of nutrient management and water quality projects that have been installed on tribal lands. And that's harder than you think to get that information, and they have had some great successes. But being able to gather those success stories and post them on a web for other tribes to be able to go and find and look at as an opportunity to put that on their land as well is a great challenge. So, but it's also, I see it as a great opportunity to gather the information. One of the other important things that we can do is build networks. One of the successes I have seen is in building networks is to really build farmer-to-farmer connections. And hearing about, as most of the researchers that have been here this week, it's great when we can go out and do a research project and show that something works or doesn't work. But for a farmer to adopt that practice or technology, a researcher is not usually going to be this best salesman. A fellow farmer who has tried it, has worked out the kinks, is going to be the one that that farmer will most likely listen to. Of course, we have our early adopters and our innovative farmers who are the ones that volunteer to do that on-farm research, but building those farmer-to-farmer networks is very important. Most farmer workshops that I have been at where farmers are talking to each other and learning about trials and tribulations of different practices that they have installed. And one of the great examples of this is with conservation tillage, residue management, and no-till. There are farmers that have never used no-till that they see a heavy residue cover crop and they think that is just, how will I ever plant my crop? How will I ever get my seed into the soil through all of that residue? But they start talking to a farmer who talks to him about how he has tweaked his planter, weighted it different, used a couple implement attachments, and then all of a sudden they can do trial and error, and they have someone to call and ask. And I am a big fan of not reinventing the wheel, and that's where these farmer-to-farmer connections come in. They can call someone and say, hey, I'm having trouble with the residue tying up around my hairpinning. What have you had this problem, and what did you do to correct it? So I think that continuing to have workshops with farmers where they can build those relationships is really important. Also, the use of technology and enhanced products. This is one that is ever-changing and always a challenge when we are creating and updating and revising conservation practice standards. We love industry, but sometimes they move a heck of a lot faster than the government does. And so trying to stay updated on technology is a challenge as far as incorporating it into our programs, incorporating it into our practice standards, and the hardest of all is really keeping our field staff up to speed and into up to speed with the current technology that's available. And there is a lot of great stuff out there: variable rate technology, enhanced fertilizers. There's just endless numbers that hopefully you've had the chance to hear about today. One of the other opportunities is soil health. We have heard, there's been several sessions, we've heard already today, the importance of soil health. And I had the ability to be on a training cadre for soil health and traveled all over the country and got to speak to our field staff and farmers about soil health. And the most important thing, whether you think it's some of the ideas are crazy or not, everyone has to agree that a healthy soil functions better. It will help the nutrient cycling. It will help the water cycling. All of the cycles that happen in soil, a healthy soil will make them function better. They also have the ability to buffer. So soil health is very important. And our agency has stood up a soil health division. I'm sure, hopefully, you've had the chance to meet Bianca. She is the head of that division, and they have hired, I think they've finished hiring their staff, which will serve throughout the country. I think they're on a regional basis, and they will be providing technical assistance, consistent assistance, science-based assistance to our staff as well as farmers and building those relationships with researchers. So I left this slide last because I figured I had already talked about it enough. Funding is always important and a great opportunity to have money to encourage people and help them put conservation on the ground is very valuable and very, very important. Even though some of these practices, like nutrient management, it's kind of a win-win. A person implements it, ultimately they will gain in the end. So that is it. I think I am good on time and have the time for a few questions. And I'll also be on the panel, so. Yes, and I don't think that all of the details of the 10 building blocks have been fleshed out, but I do know just in past meetings and discussions that we have had both internally and with partners is that nutrient management definitely will have a role as far as trying to show that nutrient management planning, and specifically for our site-specific nutrient management planning and implementation, will help with reducing emissions. So I think that it will be an exciting opportunity for us to really make nutrient management planning a priority. Not that it ever was not a priority, but I think that it's kind of been put on the back burner. It's hard to have management practices that are management-based rather than a physical practice that someone can see. So sometimes our projects will be more visual. Let's put in a buffer. Rather than management, let's teach people or help develop plans for nutrient management or IPM, some of the other management practices. So I definitely see it will be an exciting component and a way for me to get nutrient management back on the top of our agency list. So.
Any other questions for Dana?